I have spent a very long time thinking about how to start this podcast and what should be the first episode. And I've gone back and forth between it being about music, it being about history or specific dance, talking to teachers. And I keep coming back to the fact that no matter what way we look at this, I'm starting this podcast post-pandemic. And the landscape for music, for dance especially, has completely changed in areas where COVID hit hardest, which was in cities. And cities are where our strongest dance communities were and where perhaps we lost the most. So I decided to go take a local approach. That approach being that I have invited several local organizers from across the country to interview with me about what it is like to start up blues dance scenes again post-pandemic and what that looks like. We talk about things like Black Lives Matter, about how you build a team instead of just focusing on one individual to bring everything back. We talk about teachers and DJs and commercial spaces, accessibility. We talk about the pandemic and topics that I had no idea were going to come up within our conversations. I think it's valuable. I think that we need to hear from the people who are doing the grassroots work to rebuild something that they love and to build it back better, to build it back in a more sustainable way so that when bigger events happen, when national events happen, there is a community that can support those things instead of a handful of people who will burn out and have things crumble when it doesn't work out. And this episode, this very first episode of 12 Bar Talk, will be one of a series where I talk to organizers. You'll see these pop up at various times throughout this inaugural season, but I don't want it to be just a one-off thing. I think these are conversations that we should keep coming back to, that I will find myself inevitably coming back to, not just because I'm interested, but because I am an organizer in the Salt Lake City, Utah area. And it matters to me what everybody else is doing so that together we can guide best practices as a community across the nation or even internationally. My guest for part one of this organizer series is Tom DeGroe, a blues organizer in the Chicago area. I'm your host, Dr. Chelsea Adams, and let's jump in and talk about some local blues dance organizing. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You run Bluetopia, which I'm not sure that if people haven't been to Chicago or, you know, been around recently because of the pandemic, that they're aware of what that is. So could you talk a little bit about Bluetopia and its history and about yourself and how you got involved?
Absolutely. So Bluetopia, I think now is the longest running blues event, with an asterisk, of course, due to the pandemic. But it is also, it is in competition for being one of the largest monthly blues events in the country as well. It started back in 2008. Myself, Sarah Cherney, Lydia Breen, Keir Briscoe, and Ruby Red got together and decided that Chicago needed its own monthly blues event that was, well-organized, consistent, and, you know, brought instruction and quality DJs to the scene. And so we started building that up. When we got closer to the start of Bluetopia, both Sarah and I fell off because it just so happens at the same time Blue Shout was happening in Chicago, and she and I were, she was organizing it. She was, always a Blue Shout queen for the past decade, but also I was going to be heavily involved since it was in Chicago. And so we decided to fall off of Bluetopia to focus on Blue Shout and leave it to Keir, Lydia, and Ruby. But we did teach the first lesson there, so that was fun.
And what does your basic lesson look like?
So generally, our lessons are pretty light. We usually get a lot of beginners. So we stick with the basic, usually have a teacher, you know, teach one or two moves. Sometimes we'll have them focus on a basic. So for example, like when Kenneth Shipp shows up, he likes to teach the Texas Shuffle, and some others like ballroom, and some others like, you know, whatever is their particular step that they like, they'll probably teach that and a couple of moves to go with that. And also we focus a lot on the social aspect, how to navigate a floor, how to make sure you don't bump into people, and also how to ask people properly for a dance and that it's okay if they say no.
Yeah. And on that, I mean, you're saying that you've got a big crowd that shows up. How did you start to build that? Because I imagine it didn't start as the largest event, and even bringing people in beginner lessons is one of those things that it's getting people to do something new that requires them to interact with people. Often they're afraid to look stupid, or it's hard to get them to return if they have a bad experience. So how did you organically grow that?
That's a really good question. I think, and I may dodge this a little bit. I think that there were enough people that were hungry enough in Chicago that knew about, between the swing dance community, the blues community, the West Coast swing community, even like the tango community in Chicago, as long as, you know, everybody was just looking for opportunities to dance. Around 2008, swing was falling off a little bit in opportunities. In the early 2000s, I could probably find two places any weeknight to go swing dancing. And a lot of that fell to the wayside. And so there was room for blues as well. We just had to advertise. And, you know, over word of mouth is really what kept us growing. I want to say the first Blutopia, from teaching, we probably taught 16 people. And in the end, there was maybe 60 people that showed up. At the peak of Blutopia, which was, you know, 2018, 2019, we would have probably 50 people show up for a lesson. And usually around 100 to anywhere between 120 and 160 people.
Well, that's a lot of growth. And was that over the decade, or was that, you know, over about a decade? Because by the time we hit 2019, that's a different story.
I want to say our peak, we really started hitting those numbers maybe about 2015. When we had a really good venue for a very long time, which helped us out a lot, but that venue also had some difficulties. For one, they had no elevators. It was the seventh story, or the fifth story of a warehouse. So it was not easily accessible for some people. And it was also in the middle of this warehouse district. So there was, it was a bit of a double-edged sword in that, you know, people didn't think to go there, but when someone said, hey, you want to go to Blutopia, and they drive to the middle of this warehouse where, like, you know, pallet trucks are driving by and other things like that, and it gave quite an air of mystery to going to Blutopia back then. But after we moved from ATI, from that location, due to a couple of scheduling issues and some other things like that, we picked one that was first floor. It was, you know, just a regular dance studio that had plenty of parking around it. And from there, we jumped from like 110 on a good day to our debut for the new year. We had 220 people show up. But most of the time, it would average around about 130 to 150.
Well, that's a fantastic turnout. And especially considering that you're in Chicago, there's plenty to do in Chicago that keeps people engaged. So there's obvious value there. You're offering them a space to do something that they love. And speaking of accessibility, I imagine as we get into this a little more with the pandemic, how did things become more problematic or less accessible that led to like shutting down, even with that move, right? The pandemic caused everybody to shut down. So you moved, you've got a nice like growth that way, you've got this space, and then everything shuts down.
Yeah, and you know, we did actually move one other time to our current place, which is called Forte's of Fitness. They've been a long time good partner to the dance community, both swing and blues. They've hosted a lot of events throughout the years, and I intend to keep with them as long as Bluetopia is around and they're around. But you know, so Sarah, my old partner, was very into is in the healthcare industry, so she had her eyes locked on COVID as it started to show up in China and spread around the world. And so we made the decision after beginning of March, after our February Bluetopia, that we were going to shut down for the foreseeable future. Many people thought we were premature in that, but shortly after March, everybody else started shutting down. And of course, the whole nation did as well. We were expecting it to only be 6 months, as many of us were, right? And during COVID, also the other thing that we were paying close attention to was the Black Lives Matter movement, which I think that every person that's an organizer in the blues industry should have been paying a lot of attention to. And if you weren't, and you weren't vocal about it, probably should really do a lot of soul searching as to what you're doing with that event. But you know, we're now, as we go through the recovery, I'm trying to make a balance between making good and keeping in mind the progress that was made, or the highlights that the issues that were highlighted during Black Lives Matter, and applying them to the scene, while also trying to build up interest again, build up participation again as well.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. It's perfect. It leads right into it is, you know, what happened to your community, or what did you see happen to a community that's this large that just abruptly shuts down? How do you keep people engaged? Because we all did. We kept, like, people stayed engaged for like the first few months, like, oh, it'll come back. It'll come back. We think it'll be 3 months. Now it'll be 4 months. Okay, maybe six. And that just, as that drags on, more and more people, at least that I saw in communities, started dropping off and saying, well, it's just not coming back. I'll do other things. But then when you do get to reopen here, then those people are still doing other things, right?
Absolutely. And we've certainly faced that with our numbers, because we're probably at maybe 70, 80% of what we used to be, which is fine. And it is close to what I was expecting. But during the pandemic, that was difficult, because there wasn't a lot for us to do. We would encourage and keep our ears to the ground for, you know, our other friends that might be doing like an online lesson, or a DJing session, or a dancing session of some type of virtual party, and we would advertise those. But mostly what Sarah and I were doing were talking about the issues that were going on with, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement during that time. That was one of the reasons, that was one of the ways that we engaged, because we were already on that path, and we felt that it would be, I would much rather us lose the momentum of people's interest and not lose the momentum of our, I'm reluctant to use the word activism, in as organizers of a Black American dance.
Say, and yet, like, activism, I think, is a word that becomes automatically associated with a group like Black Lives Matter.
Yep.
As I've talked with other organizers about this, right? There is this anxiety about here we are, you know, largely white organizer groups, organizing dances and classes around Black social dance and Black music, purely Black art form, that has been shared with a number of us, and we want to share it with more people, but then being culturally and, like, just generally responsible, right? Which means that if you
Yes.
are involved in this, then you need to be involved in the communities. And what did you see? Because as I've talked to other organizers, they say, well, our portion of our audience said, well, I just do this to dance and have fun, and why do you make it political, right? That's almost immediately a comment that you run up against as soon as you say Black Lives Matter, where there's a lot of controversy around that particular organization, right? In the news, everywhere. How did you engage your community in a way that they responded to you in maybe the manner you're looking for, or did you have that break off of people who are upset that you've made blues political, which we already know it is, but.
Well, yeah. And that's usually my response is, I'm just here to have fun and dance. And I'm like, well, the song that you're dancing to is about lynching people. Yeah. How can it not be political? How can it not be? The politics has always been there. And it's also nice for people like them who say something like that, that they can be separated and make this, this is just about dance. This isn't about politics. Whereas, an old phrase is, you should be interested in politics because politics always takes interest in you. As a person of color, or as any type of person that might be not part of the status quo, politics is always impacting your life. Absolutely. And politics is what drove a lot of the source for the art. So when we dealt with, we didn't really talk too much to the detractors. On occasion, we would engage, for example, back in 2014 or 2013, one of the things that we did was every year our Thanksgiving event, we would donate money to a charity. And, we would do it to Southern Poverty Law, to Planned Parenthood, or other things like that. And we would get people that were very upset that we would, donate to a specific group for a certain reason. And those people I would directly engage with, and in some ways just invite them to not have to come back to Bluetopia anymore. I don't think, over the period of COVID and Black Lives Matter, I don't really recall a lot of detraction from a lot of the statements that we were making and making our intentions clear. But I do believe we lost people. They just quietly walked away.
Well, right.
And it's okay.
When you're shut down, it's hard to see who walks away, right? Like it's a little less vocal when it's so everybody's spread out or isolated in their own homes. You don't get quite the same engagement. And I think one thing you said there really struck me, which was like, you should be interested in politics because politics is always interested in you, right? Meaning, as largely white groups coming in to dance in these particular spaces need to be more aware of, hey, how are we walking in and out of spaces without problems where other people can't? So how are you and Bluetopia's organizer group helping to make it so it's maybe easier for people of color of various races, not just Black people, but say Native American, Hispanic, whoever your ethnic groups are within the space, how are you making it more welcoming or that they feel like they can cross that barrier there that maybe started out as a largely white space?
I part of it is it starts with intent. If you are genuinely interested in making a place comfortable for people, I think that is some organic process to that, but it's not that too. Like, for example, I do the photography for Bluetopia, and I have since 2015, and I make a point to take pictures of all different types of people. I am rather proud of the diverse group of people that we have at our events. Every spectrum of the rainbow, every race, creed, religion. I want to say it's not like we go out of our way and have like stickers all over the place saying that these people are welcome or this type of people are welcome. We just want everybody to be welcome. And the way I'm trying to reorganize the group is to have people from all different backgrounds play a role of some type as DJ, as instructor, as organizer, a staff organizer, or even the staff. That is still a challenge. For example, trying to get more people to DJ, more people to teach, even Chicago, as big of a scene as it was and as strong of a scene as it was, I've only got 5 or 6 teachers in the region that I can pick on.
You pointed out here a couple of things that I'd love to delve further into. One of them is your comment about like, who are you taking pictures of? How are you displaying the space without putting the stickers there that are, like, this is a friendly space, like the big shouting, right? I think a lot of times pre-COVID, what I would see is spaces where people like, we're LGBTQ friendly, like in big letters and just shouting out that, but, or, you know, we want more Black people here. But then like you'd walk in the spaces and the actions that were being taken didn't meet what was stated. So you can shout to the skies that something is welcoming and inclusive of, you know, multiple groups of people. But if they walk in and then it's not accommodating in those ways, or you're not seeing people who look like you, and you're not seeing, you know, or you do, but then there's only photos of white people being, you know, that are being shared, those types of advertisements or those types of things matter. The DJs, the teaching staff matter, but we don't want to burn people out. So when you've started back up, I imagine that's a particular difficulty, as I think it has been in all scenes. So how did you get some DJs back? How did you get it? So you even have 5 teachers. I'm actually really curious about that. Other scenes don't have, you know, 5 or 6 teachers to pull from for their spaces, and studios and dances are just really struggling to find people.
So I'm kind of cheating on that 5 dancer count, in that I do count, you know, like Andy and Courtney, who are in Grand Rapids, as part of that group, because they're usually at every Bluetopia. And in some ways, Kenneth Ship, who's down in St. Louis, everyone, he hasn't yet since we brought Bluetopia back, because that guy's all over the world right now teaching. But he's definitely somebody that we have on. And that's the thing that's honestly the most worrying for me as I try and help rebuild the scene post pandemic. You know, for example, we threw a free DJ event. Julie Brown did the instruction. She's somebody that I trust immensely to properly instruct people as to what is blues, because that often can be a pretty nebulous concept to some people. So, you know, we did the blues workshop. I'm trying to get together a teacher's workshop, you know, where we bring somebody up and, you know, like on a Sunday afternoon, we teach teachers how to teach. And on a Saturday, we'll do like a regular workshop for everybody to come. But I want to develop that again, because back in 2008, 2009, I want to say we had 10 to 15 teachers that we could access to, you know, myself included, Bob Bednarz, Sarah, Ruby, John, and John Hoven. And we had a huge number of people. And some of that was because, you know, they moved to other places and dispersed over time, and others was their, you know, their lives changed. And actually, you know, COVID changed a lot of people's lives too. Like I lost a lot of good people who were very involved during COVID.
Yeah. I think
I don't know if that answers your question, but
to some extent, yeah, I think it does. It poses even further, like more questions, but some of that, you're right. I think it's important to take a moment and recognize that we all actually lost people. It wasn't just that they fell off the scene and decided to go do something else, but like we had a lot of death around the world. And in the US in particular, right? I don't think have really taken time to comprehend or fully grasp what it means that like we can come back, but not everybody will be back, not because they couldn't, because they went to do other things, but because they actually died, they passed, right? We have less access as people moved. It's completely changed the landscape. It's changed the landscape of how you do things, and everything's online now. So it's harder to just use solely online engagement as a tool to know how many people are interested or going to show up.
I'll take that even a step further. I mean, if we believe just the raw numbers, like we lost the population of Seattle and Pittsburgh combined, you know, to COVID, but it's not just that we lost. You know, there are, I want to say there are about 7 or 8 artist facilities that we would have used back in the day for workshops or other things like that, that just folded during COVID. You know, so we lost access to venues, we lost access to bands, and, you know, the obvious one, people.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought that up, because that is a huge piece of the puzzle, especially for spaces or cities like Chicago, where you absolutely must have spaces that are more affordable or willing to work with you because they understand what you're doing and what the arts are. You can't just walk into some commercial space and be like, I want to rent this for a dance and I, you know, I'm doing this or a workshop. They don't know the difference, or it's just another number to them. And so there has been some crisis in commercial space or in opportunity, but particularly for the arts. I think we're seeing a struggle with that, which also leads right into what you said about people, teachers, DJs, musicians. When people have to turn to other things for their livelihood, it's hard to rebuild your network. So what have you been doing that have worked to bring people in to mentor? Or are you looking for a certain type of person at your dances that you think that person is somebody I want to mentor to make to see if they want to be a teacher or would make a good DJ? How are you vetting that?
Well, for starters, it's showing up and showing interest. That's first and foremost, but that's not, you know, a lot of people think that that is the primary piece of the equation, and it's not. For me, it's also understanding what you're doing and why you're doing it. You know, there are people that are very interested in helping or participating, and some of them want to do it because they just really love dancing. Some of them do it because they really love, you know, they want to be part of, you know, the center of it. They want to call shots or other things like that. And I think really what it is that I'm looking for is somebody who has enough love for it to do it for just to facilitate people dancing. Like I'm less of a dancer now than I am, than I was way back when this all started. And I do this primarily just because I know how important it is to have a place, a venue for people to dance that is safe for them, has access to good instruction, good music, authentic instruction and music, and a decent sized floor and collection of people that they can interact with and become friends with. And so trying to find people with that and also have a level of humility when it comes to you are, let's say, a custodian for an art that isn't yours. You are a guest in this artist sphere, and that they have a strong understanding that they are a guest. You know, a lot of, I've gotten feedback, Sarah and I both got feedback throughout the years that we were too strict on what blues is. And can it just be a party? Can it just be fun? And sometimes we say no. You know, we want it to be a party, we want it to be fun, but at the same time, you can't have, say, you know, Joss Stones's cover of a particular song versus that, you know, doesn't even have like pocket in its beat. You know, that's more of a swing song. Why are you playing that? Or something along those lines. Bring some authenticity to it. Otherwise, what dance are we doing? Why are we doing this? And why are we calling it what it is? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And it brings up, you know, maybe something that I think was a focus before, but I think we have an opportunity to refocus or adjust our understanding or like goal to push it forward, which is that we say blues dance. When we say Lindy Hop, people expect to know what we mean when we say, you know, let's go dance Lindy Hop or let's go dance Balboa, let's go dance West Coast Swing, salsa, zouk, like all of those things, people will go and expect what they get. Blues has always had, perhaps because of how it came up as all of a sudden this popular dance in the scene as we know it, is it was like backroom, and then people didn't really know what it was, so they just said they were dancing blues, but then it moved and morphed into fusion, which is its own conversation in itself, but we had this blues fusion is what it was called forever, so people would try and really mix those two dances, but they are two separate things. I think before the pandemic, we were seeing some success at actually splitting them and saying, you know, after all that hard work of why can't it just, you know, be this? Why can't you let this here? You're taking the fun out of it. It's like, well, you never say that about another dance, right? Do you hear people say, oh, I really wish they played like this other music that isn't salsa at a salsa dance so that I can dance something that's clearly not salsa at a salsa dance, right? Those are things that I think we saw getting better. Like people knew when we said blues, we meant blues. And then the pandemic hit and we did online events, and a lot of that fight to make sure those stayed separate disappeared. And now we're starting back. And at least in my community, fusion events started up well before blues started back up.
Seems to be the case across the board on that one.
And so I think some of the interest, at least say I'll use my community as an example, Salt and Sage Fusion specifically kept blues out of the name and has specifically run it so that their lessons say, we're going to teach nightclub basics tonight. We're going to teach blues basics tonight. We're going to teach these different things and bring in an instructor that knows. And then we're going to have a DJ that plays more of that style of music. And very clearly defining that we are not a blues dance. We are a fusion dance and we're going to structure it that way. But like you said, we still seem to be getting, when you come to blues dances, like some pushback is like, well, we just are here after the pandemic. It's opened up. We're eager to dance. Can't you just make it a party? How are you maybe, or how do you see Chicago navigating that landscape of fusion, West Coast swing, blues, all of that kind of intermingled?
Well, that's a fun and evolving answer, I think. So as somebody who was ringside for the whole fusion blues wars of, you know, the early 2000s, if you will, I still have some, shall we say, some feelings about the fusion community, but I do appreciate the way that the Chicago fusion community has been approaching it in the same ways that they don't try and align themselves with blues. And when they do instruction, they're like, hey, we're going to do, you know, a tango night, and, you know, we're going to teach, you know, a tango basic, and then you can try and incorporate it into what you know, right? So we don't have a lot of what used to be. I went to a Damon Stone class, and so I'm going to regurgitate what I learned at Damon's class and just call it fusion or call it something else. So I do appreciate that. You had a couple points to that question, if you don't mind helping me. I lost train of thought there.
Yeah, just in terms of navigating your relationship with those dances, right? Because there's a danger, I think, of becoming too isolated, but we do want to make sure that we're keeping those distinctions of saying, like, this is blues dance. These are the different dances we do. Whereas fusion is that mix. So people may be coming in and out of those spaces. Is how do we navigate building community while still like maintaining those boundaries?
So I think Chicago has been pretty well blessed. I have a decent relationship with the leader of the monthly fusion dance, Windy City Fusion. I have long-time relationships with the swing community and some people in the West Coast swing community. And we encourage them to advertise events on our Facebook page and other things like that. And when necessary, we've advertised on theirs. My only thing, like I remember a couple of months ago, a West Coast swing group came on, said something like, you know, West Coast swing was made for blues music or something like that. And I was just like, tell you what, you can keep the ad up. Just take that tagline out, because one, that's confusing. And two, yes, West Coast swing did do a lot of dancing to blues music way back in the day, but now Maroon 5 is not blues, even though it uses a blues 4/4 beat. Let's just keep our delineations clear, and we'll continue to work together.
No, and I think that's really good and important. And I know we're running low on time here, but I did want to delve just into one more topic, which is, you've talked about how long you've been a member of this community and all of the work you've done. And I think a number of us have been in, right? We're well over a decade of engagement with this dance and building local communities and a national scene, right, that is built on the backs of these local leaders and communities. So what do you think is the importance of having somebody, you know, like yourself leading the charge of like rebuilding and reestablishing post-COVID, like dances post-COVID? What is the value of that? Or how do you see yourself as a leader maybe slowly evolving into, again, like, hey, I won't be quite as involved, or do, you know, the people who have been here for over a decade need to really step up and make sure that we lead it to look like what we're hoping it looks like?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question for me specifically, because, you know, I had Sarah as a partner, and as many people who know her know, that Sarah is not a shrinking violet in any way. And is never afraid of a microphone. And not that I'm afraid of a microphone, but I've always preferred to be an operations person. You know, a lot of people didn't know who I was, even when I was taking over. They're like, oh yeah, you were Sarah's assistant or something. Like, no. So for me, I have to start upping my presence a bit and think harder about how I want to publicly present myself. But at the same time, I'm starting to look at opportunities to hand off more to people so that I can slowly back away from this, because it has been a long time. I would love to be able to mentor some people to take over Bluetopia, or, you know, find the right people to start their own, and we can slowly start to let Bluetopia fade and that one take over. Either way. But yeah, it's a fun game of both building up my public persona, if you will, for Bluetopia, but at the same time finding other people to take on those roles. And what I've always find really interesting is that everybody wants to eat the steak, nobody wants to butcher the cow. A lot of people are very interested, you know, and this is going against my public persona thing is or thoughts is that over the past 2 years, I would have people ping me all the time, when is Bluetopia going to start? And my response was always going to be, what do you want to do to help Bluetopia start back up again? And they say, well, nothing. I just was wondering when Bluetopia is back. And I'm like, you know, when the pandemic is more of an endemic or less, and when I'm comfortable that I've got the right team to help bring it back, when it's not just me. And so, you know, if you're out there listening in Chicagoland and you want to help out, please do reach out to me.
Yeah, I think that's really important, is the sense that I get from organizers who have been doing it for a decade. I've organized and gotten burned out myself, is that we try to do it all and we actually do need that team. And there does have to be a persona. It's like, you need to be able to recognize me as a person you can come ask questions to. I am an authority on this and I can give you the information. But if you are in charge of organizing teachers, DJs, the big events, the weekly or monthly event, and also trying to think like, I want to build a teacher program and I want to build this. If you don't have enough people willing to get in the trenches and actually organize, it does die, because one person does not organizing staff make.
No, not at all. And I've been very lucky, you know, that I've gotten a couple people to help with Bluetopia with staff coordination. I was able to retain a pretty good group of people to help, you know, help the front door, help set up, help tear down at the end of the night. But it's usually, you know, the same 8 to 10 people that do it. And, you know, what I want is a pool of 20 to 25 people. The same thing with DJs and dancers, or DJs and instructors, is, you know, let's get back to 10 instructors in the Chicagoland area. They don't have to be national level. They just need to be good enough so that people walk away with an authentic understanding of what blues dancing is about. Same thing with DJs.
Yeah. And to understand that it is a process, right? None of us started out DJing or teaching or organizing as pros. None of us looked at it that way.
And, you know, that's also something that I need to remind myself. And I feel that other organizers that have been doing this for a while also should keep in mind, is that, you know, the terrible mistakes that we made back in 2003, you know, thinking that something was a good idea. And, you know, like the name Cheap Thrills Blues Event, what does that imply? So part of the problem with having seasoned organizers try and build up others is that sometimes we don't give them a lot of room to make mistakes. And I don't know what the answer is. You know, sometimes you should let them make mistakes, but other times you need to prevent them from touching the hot pan. So I could see how some newer or would-be organizers might look at that as stifling. But the truth is that if you've got people who have seen this path already and are telling you don't step on that rock because you'll fall into the river, maybe you should listen to them. But also, we should probably rethink how we tell them not to step on the rock.
Certainly, because we would all, I think, like a little empathy shown to us for the mistakes that we made along the way to get where we got. And on that note, the same thing about COVID and the pandemic. We can say that the pandemic's over, the world can, you know, say that, but the fact is that COVID is still around, people still get COVID. And we're having, as local and national dance communities, having to completely, as organizers, overhaul health policies and saying like, do we require masks? Do we require vaccination? Can we require vaccination, or does our state have laws against that? Right? Like, there's a lot of spaces there, and providing empathy and understanding for organizers who are having to navigate this difficult landscape.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that, you know, Sarah and I talked about this, you know, we set some criteria up when we shut down Bluetopia that, you know, when the CDC declares, you know, that we are out of a pandemic and or, you know, our region has above 70% vaccination rates is when I would consider reopening Bluetopia. Because what I didn't want to have to do is police mask wearing as much. That just becomes, that takes away from the, you know, if we want to talk about us being strict about music and other things like that, hounding people down also on wearing masks while dancing is probably not the best, the best move to make towards making people feel welcome again. Helps a lot of people feel safe, but I definitely wanted to wait until Chicago hit certain numbers where hospitalizations were way low, deaths were even lower, and we had a high vaccination rate before we made that choice to reopen again in February.
Well, and it's great to hear that you had that in place, because I think not every space did, right? Because how do we know? There's a lot of anxiety around a pandemic and being shut down for a long period of time. And when is it safe to reopen? And there are clear metrics there that make it so even if somebody comes up with criticism, you say, well, these are the metrics that were decided upon. And with Sarah in healthcare, I think that's incredibly helpful to have somebody who understands the health science behind it.
Yeah, and Chicago as a dance scene, so, you know, traffic jam and a few other events that we have, you know, we also have another, we have two doctors that are on in that group. And so one of them is paid very close attention to what the CDC was doing and, you know, how the vaccinations are working and those impacts. So, you know, we met probably on a quarterly basis throughout the pandemic to discuss whether or not we were going to open or close, when and how, et cetera, so that we move forward with a somewhat solidified view and process, as opposed to just one team just going, we're going to do whatever we want. I think that I was very proud of Chicago for doing that.
Yeah. And I think that, like you said, alleviated a lot of stress off of you as an organizer to open a dance again and then say, mm-hmm. where do I want to exert the most energy to make sure people feel welcome, to make sure we can rebuild? And having a group of people that have decided on this, that you can build a network of people who support you in those areas, takes that pressure off so you can focus on creating the environment you care about.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to click the subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts so you always catch the latest episodes. 12 Bar Talk is hosted, recorded, and produced by me, Dr. Chelsea Adams, and supported by Salt City Blues, LLC, a blues dance event company located in Salt Lake City, Utah.